From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last Wednesday when a fleet of police chased a suspect accused of multiple shootings through the streets of Rochester. Members of the community watched the scene unfold through video posted on social media by photographers and reporters who unexpectedly found themselves caught in the middle of the gunfire. Police say the suspect, Terrell Blake, shot three people in a targeted attack. One of the victims was killed. No members of law enforcement or the media were injured, but as the Democrat and Chronicle's lead photographer, Max Schulte, said, quote, I've been in situations where officers have had their guns drawn. I've seen them surround a house, but I've never, ever seen anything like that in my entire life. I've never been that close to gunfire, end quote. If you watched the video of the chase, you saw members of law enforcement running toward the danger. You saw how close journalists were to the gunfire. This hour, we're going to talk about what that experience was like, some of the policies in place there. And if you saw Max's video, for example, you saw police officers shooting out the window of a U-Haul truck as it peeled around a corner. And in that moment, it probably didn't even feel real. It was. Usually there are perimeters set up, but this was one of those very fluid situations. And we're grateful of the work that the people who were doing in a very, very dangerous and difficult situation. Our guests this hour include Monroe County Sheriff Todd Baxter, who's back with us. Sheriff, nice to have you. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
Also with us is Max Schulte, lead photographer at the Democrat and Chronicle. Good to have you here, my friend. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Evan.
And Georgie Silverroll is a Suburban Trends reporter at the Democrat and Chronicle. Nice to have you in studio for the first time, Georgie.
Thank you.
Sheriff, for you, this is not unusual to see this. You see, if you've seen this your entire career, your officers, your deputies in multiple departments in your career have done this. For us, we're usually cordoned off somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess to you, this was, I hope not an average day, but it's the kind of thing you've seen many times.
Yeah, we had some different ending to it, you know, but the pursuit, the targeted violence that you mentioned earlier, the cordon off a block and securing crime scenes. You know, those are all normal things that we do, you know, and our officers and deputies are constantly training to run towards gunfire. But you always question if you're going to have the will when that occurs in front of you. And we seen that again the other day, that the guys and gals reacting to what we call training. You know, they reacted the way we thought they were going to react based on training that we've given them.
So I've got some questions, and I don't know that you can answer them all because there's an investigation still unfolding.
Yeah,
so we'll talk about that as the hour goes on. A brief interruption from our colleague Megan Mack, who's the producer of Connections, to tell us that this week is one of the rare times throughout the year that we interrupt just a little bit to say we need our community support. Megan.
Yes, we'll be brief. This is a very important pledge drive for us. We need all your support in the community to keep programs like this on the air, to keep conversations like this happening. I was at a community event yesterday and had a number of people come up to me and just talk about how much they value WXXI, how much they value this program in particular for thoughtful and respectful conversations. It's an opportunity to hear from local law enforcement like Sheriff Baxter. You know, it's so nice to have community leaders that are accessible and come on this program regularly, which he does, and we appreciate that. So listeners, as you're thinking about that, as you're listening to this program or the one we just did last hour about climate change, think about how easy it is to take this for granted. You wake up every morning, you hear Beth Adams on Morning Edition. She's always there. Alex Crichton, always there in the afternoon on All Things Considered. Evan, always here for Connections. What if that were to go away? How would your conversations throughout the day change? How would the way you think change? Keep that in mind. We're asking for your support. So we don't have to worry about that. And today is New Member Monday. So if you call us at WXXI, all of your dollars will be doubled today. That's also thanks to WXXI Board of Trustees member Mark Cleary. Our thanks to him. And you can call our volunteers. They can help you. You can go online to WXXINews.org and make your pledge of support there. Evan's going to give you the number and more ways to give back to the station. And you'll continue to listen throughout the hour.
All right, Megan, thank you very much. All right, so I've known Max Schulte for a number of years and always admired your work here. I'm with you. When I saw the video that you posted, I had not seen and I had not experienced something like that. So something that Georgie, Max, and I and our colleagues, we did reach out, by the way, to Will Morgan of 13 Wham News, who also had a very harrowing piece of video in which it appears that the suspect aimed his gun directly at Will when he's coming around the corner. I've worked with Will for a number of years. Would love to have him on today. I know he was not available. 13 Wham does not make their people available unless it's the GM. So, but Will, we're thinking about you. I know it was a tough day. Tell me a little bit more about what you remember about what happened last Wednesday and sort of when you realized just how immediate it was, Max.
So Wednesday morning, I arrived at the DNC newsroom to start my shift, and we heard a radio call come over that there had been a double shooting.
Get right on your mic for me,
sorry.
There, buddy.
That's sorry, right. Bud.
I know you're usually not on the mic. I get it. I get it.
So the radio call comes in. RPD is responding to a double shooting. We're also getting some word that one of those shootings is possibly fatal. A photographer sitting across from me runs out to catch that. And the next thing we know, we've got another phone or another radio call coming in over RPD stating that a man had been shot at school 25 on the playground. That's an unusual call to hear, and something that we jump on immediately. So I just picked up my gear, I got in a car, and I flew over there as fast as I could. It turns out that the subject had been wounded in the upper body. It was not a life-threatening situation. He had already been transported by the ambulance. And so we're watching this dynamic where parents are showing up at the school very concerned. They're very concerned for their children. They're concerned for the safety of, you know, their community and the kids within the building. And so that is the story that we start to cover, you know, as these, you know, concerned parents coming to pick their kids up at the school that just had this incident take place, you know, several feet from their playground. The shooting, I believe, did not occur actually on the playground, but the man then stumbled into the playground, which then, you know, caused concern for the school administration there and principals, and they, I think, immediately went into a lockdown situation. As this is all kind of unfolding very calmly, very routinely, it seems, you know, almost, you know, textbook. I start to notice officers down the street pulling out long guns, a little heavier artillery than what you normally see.
In a minute, Sheriff will correct any of the terminology.
Yeah, right.
He's accurate.
Okay, very good. Okay.
And they, you know, they seem to be in a state of heightened alert, and that's when I kind of made my way down to the intersection of North Goodman and Forrester Street, because that's where the action kind of was happening. And we're typically drawn to, you know, the action. We're looking to show what's happening, you know, what the responses are and what's taking place, you know, as, you know, crime scenes or incidents like this, you know, unfold. You can hear a little shudder in my voice. I'm just a little trying to react this here. It brings back a little bit of the time, so I'm just trying to take this slowly so I can do it accurately. So this unfolds, and Will Morgan, we just mentioned, comes down and stands next to me, and he says, "Man, I think this guy's heading our way." And I took up a position by a tree along the sidewalk so that I could, you know, maybe have something to kind of like be behind if there was a vehicle chase coming or something like that. And sure enough, all of a sudden I turn left, or I look south on North Goodman down to Bay, and there goes the van, and there goes about another 20 cop cars behind it. And then about 2 minutes later, I look north and the van goes by on Hudson, and we're literally surrounded. We're in a sea of police vehicles. The SWAT vehicle was in that chase. And I thought that was the last we'd see of, you know, Mr. Blake in the van. Well, I look down the street and here comes the van at us. And I turned the camera on and started rolling. And, he made the turn on the North Forest. And if you watch the video, you'll hear the gunshots and you'll see him try to basically, I think, fire on the officers that he was going by as he was making this right-hand turn through a barricade. I believe there was RPD and sheriff's officers manning that barricade. And then he continues down North Forest and makes a left onto the street where he eventually was shot and killed.
In the video that we see from you, the window, the driver's window, gets shot out.
So yeah, you do see a lot of gunfire. You see actually smoke barrel smoke from, you know, law enforcement officers discharging their firearms at a very close range. Whether that window, I'm not a expert in law enforcement, whether that window is being blown out or blown in, I think is up for debate.
Okay.
I know that gun was pointed at, the gun that Mr. Blake had in the van was pointed at Will Morgan from Channel 13. If you look at his video, you can see him clearly pointing that gun at him. I later went and reviewed my video from that, from further down the road. And when I mean further down the road, as the van approaches, I'm looking at through the windshield, as Mr. Blake's van is approaching towards me, and I've slowed down the video, and you can clearly see him pointing a handgun out the window, or I shouldn't say out the window, but towards the window, because the window was rolled up.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, again, getting back to the glass in or out, I think from a ballistic standpoint, if you shoot at something, you know, you would see, tend a bullet would go through something and blow in. If something's blowing out, that means a projectile is possibly coming out as well, or maybe that gun was so close that the concussion, you know, from that weapon being fired blew the window out.
But there's a number of shots, and, you know, how close do you think you were? 40 feet at the time? 30 feet?
Probably closer to 20.
20 feet.
20, 15.
Closest you've been to active gunfire?
Well, I shot skeet and trap all through college.
No, that's not what I'm talking about.
I'm an avid hunter. I've been around gunfire. This is a different type of gunfire. This is obviously a heavy barrage of, you know, of noise that, you know, frankly, has kept me up at night a couple of times since this all happened. So it was shocking. It was something that, as I heard it go off, I said, don't, in the back of my head, I was like, don't flinch. Just don't flinch. You got to just keep rolling. Just keep rolling. And don't let that affect, you know, don't let this affect you right now.
Can I just ask you briefly then? Let's get our colleagues' hats off and just as your friend.
Yeah.
I'd have been okay with you getting behind that tree and not thinking, don't flinch.
I think it happened all so fast that if I was, I was in journalist mode. I really was. I wasn't in a flight or fight mode. I equate it to, being a surgeon. I mean, when a surgeon is, you know, performing surgery, they're not concerned with the blood squirting, all over. They're trying to save somebody's life. I wasn't concerned with, jumping behind a tree. I was concerned with getting the picture or getting the video.
I'm going to ask you a macabre question then. Did anything quickly go through your mind, like, if I'm getting shot, I'm getting shot, but I'm not stopping this camera?
Didn't even think about
didn't
that.
Think about, you didn't
no.
Because it did happen very fast.
And I can tell you, the officers who were behind that barricade there, they knew we were there. They knew we were there. They understood that there were citizens in the area. My hats are off to those guys for the discipline that they engaged in. I've been doing this a long time. I mean, you know, Todd and I were joking outside that there was a time when I did a ride along with him, and he put me in a van with some guys who were targeting open air drug markets, and there was a bulletproof vest or bulletproof blanket hanging in the van. I said, "Why is this blanket in here?" They pulled the blanket back and they showed the gun holes that were through the bullet holes that were through the van because they had been targeted by these drug dealers. So I understand and I appreciate what these guys do, what our law enforcement community does. I think their training is top notch. And you know, the wild card in all this was Mr. Blake. Really, my concern with the officers, I didn't feel like I was in jeopardy from them. Obviously, Mr. Blake was something to be concerned of, and that's again why I kind of posted up by this large tree so that I could protect myself. If that van came down that street, you know, at least had something that would stop that van if it came up on the sidewalk. I would at least have something to hide behind. I'm sorry, I lost track of thought here. You asked me about, I guess, you know, getting back to the whole processing thing about, you know, yeah, again, it was just, I was in journalist mode and I wasn't thinking in that way. I mean, I think about it now, you know, the adrenaline rush that, you go through when you have something like that happen, I'm starting to feel the effects of that now. I'm my body is like, I thought going back to work was going to be something that would be good for me and that I would be able to kind of have my, take my mind off that. And that was probably the wrong choice. I'm going to take a couple of days off after I get done here with you.
Sorry.
And just try and regroup and let the physical aspects of it, catch up, you know, try and catch up physically with, you know, some rest and some sleep and, you know, take my mind out of, you know, the day-to-day stuff at work, the day-to-day social media, the day-to-day, you know, rigors of my job.
Mm-hmm. I want to make clear that this tragic story is really about a family targeted by an individual. And there's no intention to lose sight of that. This hour, the discussion is about the work that is done by journalists, video and photo journalists, reporters, and by law enforcement. But I want to just acknowledge that this is about a family that had a tragic Absolutely. And just a devastating day, and we feel for everyone in that family and connected to them.
Well, and there were a lot of teachers and yeah. school children affected by this, too.
I mean,
they locked down schools, and I mean, it really affected the whole community, you know, in the fact that, you know, people were, you know, really kind of put through the ringer to some aspect because of all of this.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Sheriff, first of all, from what Max described, was it a pretty fair description of what some of the chaos that he was seeing?
Yeah, and I just got to take a step. We could do the show for a couple hours just based on what Max just said. It's incredible that the similarities between our jobs, right? When that stress, we train police officers exactly like this. When that stress gets to that level, you're going to revert back to habits and training. And that's why it's so important. And that's exactly what Max just said. He reverted back to his job. His job was to capture that video. And there's no cognitive thought there. There's no, you know, reasoning sometimes, too, with your own safety.
It's not time.
You revert back to training. And on the other end, you know, the law enforcement officers reverted to their training. And when that car actually penetrates the traffic control point as opposed to going by it, there's not a lot of time to put a mental thought process in here. What possibly is occurring now and what's going to occur next? It's so unusual and so stressful that you're going to revert back to training. So the similarities are there. Humans are humans, whether you wear a blue uniform or not. The idea is condition your mind for those situations as much as possible. And then the post-traumatic, I mean, that's got to be acknowledged too, that everybody's going to be suffering through this. And thank God in our world that we do mandatory post-traumatic the day of the incident, and our guys had to go back, guys, and get two separate times throughout a certain time period. Just to make sure we're capturing and working them through that process, because every human goes through it.
How many departments were involved? Last Wednesday.
Total of four departments. So Irondequoit PD was there. It's New York State Police, obviously, the city, and then the sheriff's office responded.
The video that Max had, Will Morgan had, you know, shows what you see all the time, Sheriff, mm-hmm. which is officers running toward the danger, really exposed, mm-hmm. in what is obviously, to say the least, a volatile and dangerous situation. And I think what I want to just do is acknowledge that, because there are a lot of conversations, rightfully so, about law enforcement, what we should expect of them. But that moment just reminds us mm-hmm. of what you may wake up and face every day. And I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I do. There's a reason why I love being in a uniform. There's a reason why I love cops. There's a reason I love what I do for a living. And now I have the opportunity to lead those types of men and women. You can't find a career quite like that where guys and gals are willing to risk it all for a total stranger. They didn't know what was going to occur next. They didn't know that guy was going to go back to the house. The intel was telling us that he might come back to the house. The intel was telling that he might, you know, try and get to that block, but you would never assume someone would do that. And then to see how they react, you know, that they flinched, but they flinched in the right way. They flinched forward incoming rounds, you know, trying to defend other people's lives further on down that block. You see an RPD officer and a deputy while running towards the gunfire, reloading their handguns. You don't think about those things. You just react to, you know, God forbid they have to fire that gun again, that they're ready to do that. You know, those are, we call it heroics, but I don't know what term you put on it. Those just good people. They're good Americans. They're good people, and I'm proud to be amongst them.
I want to ask you a little bit about what Max described. In that moment, one thing that he described remembering feeling is not any sense of fear that any bullets flying would endanger him if they came from law enforcement. Mm-hmm. In other words, you've got a situation where a guy is flying down the street in a truck and obviously has killed or tried to kill multiple people, is capable of doing anything. Mm-hmm. But Max is not thinking that if gunfire erupts, that he'd be in danger from law enforcement. It certainly could be in danger from Mr. Blake. But how do you train in those moments where you have to react to make sure that if I have to draw this weapon, that I am going to do everything possible to make sure that my target is where this shot's going, and that, mm-hmm. that to the extent there's people in this neighborhood, there's people, sure. we haven't been able to create a perimeter, that we're going to keep it as safe as we can.
Yeah, and that's the key term. When you got something this violent occurring, the rampage, if you will, a very dynamic, mobile environment, as safe as possible. You know, to say we're going to make it 100% safe is impossible. You're trying to do a risk versus reward. So it goes back to training. You know, we train, you know, basic marksmanship skills, how to line up a front sight, rear sight, pull the trigger, and hit a paper target that's not shooting at you. And then you go to inoculate folks into real-life combat and decision-making through different tools that we have. And we talk about the, you know, things like know your target. You got to identify that as a deadly physical force threat, but also know what's beyond it. And we train that. You know, we train with friendlies going behind what we call friendlies, you know, people that are innocent. We train with, you know, opening both eyes and seeing the whole picture. You're going to initially get tunnel vision. It's human instinct to get tunnel vision on that threat when a gun's pointing at you. But as soon as possible, open up both eyes, you know, and grasp the whole situation and try and see. You heard it on the air. You know, the second volley of shots fired around the corner. From the video, you heard a first-line leader get on the air, backstop, look at your school, look at the school. Although the school was a backstop.
Again, backstop meaning?
Yeah, what's beyond the target? What's beyond the threat in front of you? We own every one of those bullets. You know, where it ends up is very unpredictable sometimes. It hits metal, it hits a brick, it ricochets. We still own it. No one's going to care that it ricocheted, you know, three times and hit an innocent kid. They're just going to say we hit an innocent kid, you know. So those are the tough things when you're firing projectiles out of an end of a barrel that you not only the deadly physical force threat rate in front of you, you got to make that mental decision, very important decision, life-changing decision, but also what's the innocent beyond that? You know, do you have clean backdrops? It might be parked cars, you know, it might be a school, but a school wall as opposed to a school with a playground full of kids, but you have to process all that information in a very minute second. And as we said earlier, a lot of this is habitual. You've either trained that habit in your brain to identify target, backstop, and beyond, or you're not going to be thinking about it when you're getting a gun pointed at you and you're starting to pull the trigger yourself.
I don't know if you can comment at all about Max's taking us through when that window shatters, and I suspect you've seen his video.
Sure.
If we know where the fire was coming from when that window of the truck shatters.
Yeah, if you allow me to put the asterisk in front of this statement.
Of course.
You know, the RPD is doing a phenomenal piece together investigation from step A all the way through, who knows how many letters it's going to end with. This is an incredible investigation, but you know, I looked at the back of the patrol car, the sheriff's car. It does have what I believe is the impact of a bullet in the back of it. It does have glass shrapnel on it, which I believe is blowout from the window. With that all being the caveat that the investigation, I'm not doing the investigation, and I'm probably speaking out of turn. But the fact is, you know, they were menaced, and I believe a projectile was fired in their direction. And it just goes back to, I'm saying this from the standpoint that, you know, there was an RPD officer standing right to the immediate left of the vehicle, and my deputy was right behind the vehicle and the engine block, if you will. And, you know, that projectile probably went right over the deputy's head, and he probably didn't even realize it at that moment. You know, he's just responding to training. This is an ongoing threat to them, but it's also a threat to what's further down that parking lot or that street, and they're going to react.
In this case now, I think it's also important to say, as the sheriff just mentioned, multiple departments, we reached out to multiple departments. Not everyone was available on short notice on this Monday afternoon. So the sheriff is here, but you know, certainly our appreciation for the work of RPD, State Police, Irondequoit PD.
Irondequoit, yes, sir.
So thank you, and it's just a matter of who's available today. They're busy. Everybody's got things to yeah. Everybody's got things to do. From your standpoint as someone who leads a department, when this is ongoing, you have no idea how it's going to end. You don't know if one of your officers, one of your deputies, everyone's lives are at risk. You don't know if anyone in the public. I mean, this is a remarkable scenario mm-hmm. that no one else ends up getting hurt here, isn't it?
It is. It is. Whether the vehicle's creaming through those traffic control yeah. points, it ran over a fire hydrant, you know, it was going over curbs. We're asking for spike strips to be deployed. If it hits a spike strip, you know, sometimes it goes offline and exactly why Max is standing behind a tree. We don't know where that vehicle's getting up. That was the imminent threat initially during the pursuit, you know, what the vehicle and all the police vehicles are doing. You know, you just don't know, and how this thing unfolds, it's so unpredictable. And you got to train for the unpredictable part. Training is so key here. Selection of good cops, good character is the bedrock. But, you know, continuously training these guys and gals for the unknown and to work in that environment is something we can never stop. You know, most people don't realize we go to the range twice a year. You know, think about that. Your favorite baseball team or football team warms up before every game. Twice a year. Think about that. Yeah, these guys are warming up twice a year, not only on the physical skills of all the things that we have to do, but the cognitive skills. You know, and don't forget, we got to throw, you know, all the other training we all have to do, sexual harassment, and, you know, these are all training hours that we put in. You know, it's a very limited amount of training, and we are always pushing to do as much training as possible because you don't have an opportunity to warm up before these incidents.
After our only break of the hour, I'm going to ask Georgie Silverall, the reporter from the Democrat and Chronicle. Yeah, I mean, how long she's been in the department and whether an event like this shakes you up a little bit. You know, you want to do the work of journalism. Sometimes this is where it takes you, though I don't think usually this extreme. But we're having that conversation about what happened last Wednesday in those chaotic moments. You heard Max Schulte, lead photographer at the Democrat and Chronicle, Georgie Silverall from the Democrat and Chronicle, and Monroe County Sheriff Todd Baxter. It's our only break of the hour, and right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. The Rochester chapter of the World Affairs Council is looking at the Trump administration's policies and strategies around the world. On Tuesday, they're looking at Asia, and our guest, who is a guest of the World Affairs Council, is not only the director of the South Asia Center, but has managed programs in arms control, disarmament, and more. We'll discuss it Tuesday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. During our brief break, lead photographer from the Democrat and Chronicle, Max Schulte, was just stressing a point that I think probably bears mentioning again on air, which is that whatever the public was making of where you were and how you got there, this wasn't a case that usually happens. We've all been there where there's something happening and there's a perimeter established. And one of my old colleagues at 13WAM, who's now retired, Paul DePascal, used to be really good at getting around perimeters. I don't know if you know that, Sheriff Baxter.
Yeah, find him in backyard sometimes. Like,
we called him Chief. Chief DePascal was chief videographer at Channel 13. And my goodness, was he good at finding a way to the scene and sometimes putting himself in danger. But I love you, Paul. But usually that's the case. In this case, it came to you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that just to quell the misconception, you know, the media was there to cover a shooting. You know, we weren't out there actively pursuing or being involved with this chase. You know, we weren't actively pursuing the kill zone. The kill zone came to us. I mean, so, you know, we found ourselves basically, you know, alongside law enforcement reacting to, you know, basically somebody who was looking to do a lot of destruction and a lot of harm to, you know, anybody who might have been standing around could have been, you know, a potential victim. So, you know, it's a little unsettling to, think about being in that situation. You know, we were joking about Paul jumping, you know, into yards to try and find stuff. You know, look, we all push the envelope a little bit. You know, we want to get the picture. We want to get the story. We want to show what's going on. But, you know, no picture and no video is worth getting killed over. Although there are journalists who have been killed. I mean, if you think about Chris Hondros, the special on Netflix. The guy was an outstanding war photographer, and, you know, he took a sniper bullet in Yemen. The Netflix documentary, I think, talks a lot about why we do what we do as journalists.
I think you're on the mark, though, that I think when I mentioned people like Paul DePascal and all of us in those situations, we try to push the boundaries. Sheriff Baxter, we don't do it to disrespect law enforcement. I just want you to know
Thank you for saying that.
Because you establish perimeters for a reason. Does what happened last Wednesday change anything when it comes to how you're going to state the obvious? That was a fluid situation that was going mm-hmm. from different scene to different scene. But does this impact at all how you're going to handle things going forward?
Yeah, as you think about, we establish inner perimeters and outer perimeters, and those are designed to identify the kill zone and keep people out of the kill zone, right? And identify for law enforcement that we don't accidentally wander into a kill zone. Those are all natural things, and it's designed to cordon off a problem and minimize the expansion of the problem. The first thing you do is set a perimeter around it, and the problem you have inside that perimeter is your problem. It doesn't get any bigger because we coordinate it off. And the situation the other day, you've seen the suspect drive into our perimeter, right? Intentionally drive around two traffic control points into our perimeter, which, again, is something that we go back and we look at. You know, we've trained for this in a terrorist-type environment in the past where, you know, we got to secure, you know, vital infrastructure inside the county of Monroe. You know, we got to secure 911. We got to secure water treatment plants. And we set up perimeter points and traffic control points to keep, you know, vehicle-borne IEDs, improvised explosive devices. But, you know, in a targeted violence criminal act, you know, this is something that's pretty unusual from that standpoint. So we got to go back and look at those things. If we're going to isolate out a block to keep someone from penetrating it, then, you know, we definitely, every chance we get to learn what suspects are doing, we always take advantage of that. We call it debriefings. Go back, what went right, what went wrong, how do we improve it? And here's just another example of, you know, he's intent on getting back into that block for some reason. We're getting that intelligence. Could we do something different? I don't know if we could or not, but, you know, maybe, you know, getting spike strips out more often or getting spike strips more available or more training. I don't really know if they're available. I'm just saying those are things we naturally go through a process mm-hmm. of what can we do better? Do we need more equipment? Do we need something different?
I'm going to get back to what they can do and some of the tools they have at their disposal in those moments. But I'm going to ask Georgie Silverol, who's a reporter with the Democrat and Chronicle, a reporter since when? How long have you been at the DNC?
I started on September 4th, I think. So I've been at the DNC for almost a month and a half.
What do you remember about last Wednesday?
It's interesting because I'm learning a lot more about it by having this conversation. So when you get sent out to a shooting, it usually has already happened. You're going to the scene after the fact. Mm-hmm. You're going to get some basic information. Sometimes you get lucky enough to go with a photographer. They get photos. You try to talk to anybody who witnessed it, and it's usually pretty straightforward. You don't actively go into, you know, something that's happening like this. And so when we went out on Wednesday, I don't think anybody really expected it, especially not me. I was looking back on it. The thing that frightens me the most is how unprepared I was and how, I mean, I'm nervous just thinking about it because I didn't know it was coming. And I think I'm very lucky that I was with Max because he did. It was weird. Right before, you know, everything came through our way, he had seen everyone with their guns drawn and standing there, and he knew something was up, and it was really weird, like how intuitive you were to the situation. And so, I mean, for me, I'm 22. I started my career almost 2 years ago when I graduated from school, and I mean, I've covered shootings and drownings and car accidents, and, you know, I've done other stuff, but never anything like this. And I think it's, it's definitely a great experience. I'm glad I had the chance to be there and to, you know, cover something like that. And then afterward, I actually stayed around the scene and got to talk to some family members and witness the other side of that, you know? I mean, we're never there for the beginning when everything's unfolding. And so to see that and then to watch the family react and see people, like, literally fall to the ground screaming and crying, mm-hmm. and it was just, I mean, you don't really get to do that all that often, especially not me being so new to this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just to touch back on that, that's another part of, you know, some of the process that I know law enforcement and journalists have to go through, too, is, you know, we are engaging with people who have just, you know, had probably the most horrific thing happen in their lives. So, you know, a little bit of that rubs off on us as well. So, you know, to be caught up in the physicality of it and then be touched by the emotional aspect of it by talking to these family members and witnesses, you know, there's a lot to process there. And those things, those are the things that, you know, stick with you. You'll remember that for a long time.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Where were you when everything was happening?
Pretty close to Max. I was a little bit further up Goodman toward the school. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, we were in the same area.
You could hear the gunfire.
Oh, yeah. The thing that scares me the most is, like, I mean, I went home that night, and Max and I were talking about that on the way over. I could not stop replaying the whole day in my head, and I was very frustrated with how naive I was. And whereas other people, like Max, was prepared and was ready to hide behind something, like, I did not even see it coming. And I think that's, you know, I mean, being new to it, that's, I mean, I had no idea what to expect. I had no clue. And you can't really prepare for that because it doesn't really happen. And it's not really something I think my editors would have sent me into if they had known it was going to happen.
Yeah, there's a difference there between what the sheriff is talking about with training your men and women, mm-hmm. because ultimately, if you become a deputy, become an officer, you will be in a situation like that, and you will have to do it for the first time, and you have to be prepared the first time. Georgie's right. As a journalist, there's not really preparation until you do it, and you have to see how you react to it.
I mean, if it happens again, I'll be much more ready and prepared and know what to do, but I'm kind of hoping it doesn't happen for a while.
Well, and I also want to make an important point, because Max just brought up and Georgie and the sheriff talk about protecting the public around a scene like that, watching the family members and friends and neighbors react. I don't know that the media always does a very good job contextualizing crime. So whatever your image of certain neighborhoods or parts of our city, parts of our community are, I mean, the vast, vast majority, you go door to door, meet people. People will give you the shirt off their back. They don't, even if they don't have very much, they want a peaceful neighborhood. This is a shock. This is not a daily occurrence. And that doesn't mean there isn't daily danger, but my goodness, it shakes the world of anybody like it would anywhere. And I want to ask, I think all of our guests, and I'll start with you, Max, how do you bring humanity to what is just a devastating set of events that no one would want to be in?
Well, in this situation, and we've kind of touched on, I hope that what people outside of the initial shock and awe, I mean, if you listen and see the video for the first time, you know, take a step back and watch it again and watch it at the end. And we talked about the officers running to the danger. And I think that, you know, as a journalist, one of the things I'm trying to show in our community is our neighbors. You know, these officers are our neighbors. You know, Georgie isn't our neighbor. You're our neighbor, right? So I want to educate our readers and our community, you know, as to what these officers have put themselves through and what they go through. So I want people to understand that through this video. And the rest of my work is basically what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to make our community feel something, right? Whether you're angry or upset or happy, you know, I hope my work generates or, you know, has somebody feel something towards someone, you know, the subject matter. You know, and in this case, I think that, you know, the humanity is that we've got some good, well-trained law enforcement in our area who probably have the community's best interests at heart at all time and are willing to risk their lives to, you know, make sure that community is safe.
Georgie, what are you making them?
I mean, I think the biggest thing we can do is tell the truth. And, you know, this day wasn't just me and Max. It was an entire newsroom effort. I mean, we had several reporters on this. We had another reporter, Megan Finnerty, who was at another area, you know, trying to get information over there. We had people like Sean Lehman and Gary Craig and Steve Orr digging into, you know, Terrell Blake and seeing what they could find on him and trying to bring some context to the situation. And so by the time Max had come back with this fantastic video showcasing like what had happened and the gravity of the situation, and I mean, we had a handful of other reporters who were piecing things together. I was tweeting things out. I was calling our editors and I was calling our my coworkers and relaying information back. And like, I mean, I think the most important thing that we did was we gave it our all and we tried to relay to the public like the intensity of the situation, what happened, you know, try to explain the level of danger, what had happened. And I mean, just doing our best to get as much information out there as quickly as we possibly could, which is our job with everything. But it's not often we are put in a situation where something is unfolding right in front of us and we've got to react in that moment. And I think like our collective newsroom and other, you know, media outlets in the area did a really, really good job at responding to that situation.
Sheriff Baxter, how do you view sort of the question on, in amidst the chaos, you know, respecting the pain and the humanity that people may be feeling there?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I am so grateful that the public got to get a glimpse inside our world, right? And understand there's humanity, there's character, there's confidence, obviously, inside that blue uniform. But at the end of the day, when they go home and take that uniform off, they're a mom, they're a dad, they're a brother, a sister, you know, they're human beings inside that blue uniform. They're not supermen that have a sterile, you know, environment and they just go to work. Whatever side you want to take on critiquing police officers, you know, those are human beings inside there. And Georgie said it earlier, you know, sticking around the scene afterwards, after everybody goes through the adrenaline dump, the community goes through the adrenaline dump. You know, there's several people in that community that had gunfire coming towards their house. And we try and we go up and talk to them and debrief them and get our witness statements from them. And then we leave and they're still left with like, all right, where'd everything go? I mean, there's got to be empathy and compassion for people that live in through those environments, whether you're a reporter, a law enforcement officer, a firefighter. But if you're a citizen, so what, and there's some tough neighborhoods in the city of Rochester that these folks experience quite, you know, often violence around them. And we can't forget. There needs to be this sense of empathy and compassion for everybody, whether you wear a blue uniform, you're a reporter, you're a citizen, innocently just sitting on your front porch when this all unfolds. You're all touched by it. You know, Max mentioned the school. I mean, that school, I can only imagine how many debriefings they're going to go through with the kids and the right thing to do. But, you know, how many of those kids that grow up in tough environments have experienced this stuff in the past?
I think about neighborhoods, as you say, where there are higher rates of violence. And yet, even still, the people who are committing fatal shootings, or acts of violence is a small number compared to the amount of neighbors who just want to be in a safe place.
Yeah,
and they've got to be so
do.
Frustrated.
We all do, don't we? We all just want to go home at the end of whatever our day looks like, tuck your kids in and be safe and secure while you sleep at night and be safe and secure while you send your kids off to school. That's all we want. You know, and the rest is secondary. You know, throw that up there with health. I mean, money, all the good things in life that we take, you know, we all just want to be Maslow 101, you know, safe and secure And that's the part about being a cop that I love so much is I don't like bullies. You know, I don't like people out there, you know, taking advantage of these people that don't have a lot. And then they also bully them through their neighborhoods. That just frustrates the heck out of me, you know. So, you know, it's that empathy and compassion. We all need to keep on reminding ourselves because we get callous in life.
Yeah, and Evan, just, you know, Georgie talked about working in his team and talking about the humanity. You know, Sean Dowd, my colleague, was out there. And I don't know if you saw the picture he made of the aunt. You know, just hugely emotional with her arms out, screaming
picture.
Up at the sky.
Incredible.
And, you know, that just goes to show, you know, that this impacted everybody who was involved, whether, you know, you were law enforcement trying to contain the suspect or you were the suspect's family. We tried to show the humanity behind both sides of the story. And I think that's important in what we do as journalists is to show, you know, a range of emotions and feelings from everybody involved.
Perspectives, absolutely. So that photograph you're talking about was taken by made by who?
By Sean Dowd.
Yeah, he's a staff photographer with the DNC.
Yeah, yep. Sean, appreciate your work. Bill in Fairport emails the program to say, I think it should be mentioned that the reporters of the Democrat and Chronicle have done a magnificent job of covering local breaking news despite cuts to staff and page space available for local stories. So, you know, it's not fair to Max and Georgie to ask them about cuts to staff. They're working. They're doing their best with it. But I just want you to know that people like Bill and Fairport are emailing the program. They're aware of the situation. They have great appreciation for the work that you and the department is doing there. So,
well, thanks, Bill. Appreciate
yeah.
it.
Yes,
yeah.
Thanks, Bill.
Georgie, has this changed your view at all about what you want to do with your career?
Absolutely not. No. I love what I do. For the most part, my job is, it is wonderful for all of it, but for the most part, I'm not really covering crime or breaking news to this extent. I write, you know, stories about mostly the most wonderful thing or something great that somebody created or an interesting part of someone's life. Like, I meet new people every day, and I love it, and I wouldn't shy away from it just because I had one experience that was slightly scary. I mean, I can't even imagine being, in law enforcement. I couldn't do it every day, but, I wouldn't trade it for the world. And I mean, we've already kind of gushed about our colleagues a little bit, but I really have a lot of faith in the staff that we work with. And I mean, Max threw me in his car basically after this happened and got me, safely away from the scene when everything was unfolding. And like, I don't think everybody has a coworker who would help them without a doubt. Like, I don't think it works that way for everybody.
No, it's great stuff. I mean, I'm a big defender of, as our listeners know, print journalism, what we do here at Public Broadcasting, the journalists in our newsroom, and our colleagues around this town. And I hope that this week we're in the middle of a membership campaign, and I hope everyone is thinking about, what does it take to fund journalism? What is my role here? What's the value? You know, when Sheriff says he's happy, not happy is the wrong word, there's something that is positive about at least the community getting to see kind of behind the curtain, because there's no way you'd ever allow Georgie and Max and Will Morgan to be there. You can't.
You can't
guarantee their safety. But the fact is, they're okay. They were not injured. And we got this opportunity. There's value in at least seeing it more up close, I guess.
Yeah, and being on the receiving end of some stories that I don't often like, from journalism, because I'm a law enforcement officer, I cannot imagine our country without, right? It's a bedrock of our community. It's a bedrock of our Constitution that we have this free, open, journalism and can tell the stories the way they see it and the way they believe it, let other people judge. But, it was a great glimpse into what we do for law enforcement and show the heroics. But it's also a bedrock of our Constitution, and I believe in it 100%.
I got a couple minutes left, so I do want to ask some procedural questions because you mentioned a few different things. What are the strips that you use to slow a car?
Spike strips.
So how does it work? Is it generally pretty effective? If I go over a spike strip, I'm going to be disabled?
Yeah, your tires are going to go flat, and probably several police cars following you are going to go flat too, because they're probably going to hit the same spike strips. The hard part.
Have you gone over spike strips?
I have not gone over spike strips. Thanks. but it's always a good laugh when a couple cop cars lose their tires. They're very expensive, by the way, as I control budgets now.
Yeah. You're very aware of that now.
But the spike strips are also very dangerous to deploy. You have to get in front of what you guys experience. Chase going down one block, then it's coming up the other block, and so you got to try and predict where it's going to end up, and then you have to get out there in the middle of an open road, and you actually got to throw these things across like an accordion and pull them back with a string. You're exposed. We've had police officers in the city of Rochester get hit while deploying. You're out there in no man's land, but again, you're on that verge of what almost like deadly physical force. You got cars flying through intersections and the risk versus reward, but it's a very dangerous thing to deploy.
And then on the subject of a chase, I think I'm curious to know, when there is someone who's committed acts of violence and is flying down city streets or wherever the case may be, any street, any road, and law enforcement is chasing. You are, I assume, chasing to keep the suspect in sight, to understand where they are. But ultimately, what is the sort of end goal of the chase to sort of disable? And obviously, the best case is that person stops, puts their hands up. That's the end
please,
of that.
But
every time. Are you trying to force that person off the road? Are you trying? What's the goal and the mindset of a chase?
Yeah, so obviously we've met the criteria to chase. Every department has a policy now, a pursuit policy. So we have the risk versus reward. This apprehension has to be made, or else there's going to be more danger to the public, as a simple example. With that being said, our goal is for him to stop. Simply put the car in park and put your hands out the window. Everything's going to be just fine. From there on out, it's to apprehend the suspect. Most often they end where the suspect gets out and bails, what we call bails. They run. They'll hit a certain neighborhood they're comfortable in and get out of the car and go as fast as they can on foot, hoping that we can't set a perimeter around where they're running to or get a canine out as quick as possible. So that's really our goal. Our goal is stop. Our second goal is probably going to end up with a foot pursuit. Most often they do.
So they are most often going to stop on their own and run. What happens in a I guess in a situation where if you're coming from both ends here, mm-hmm. will you force that vehicle to stop physically? Will you try to essentially crash into it?
No, that in most policies, they would be considered deadly physical force. Okay. It's like firing your firearm gotcha. Or hitting someone in the head with a baton. We're not allowed to set up roadblocks, as an example, unless you're at a deadly physical force scenario. So we were waiting for that foot. And as you listen to the audio the other day, you hear the sergeants and lieutenants talking about parallel. You know, we got several vehicles. They naturally always end up in a train because that's where the suspect's leading us. But then we try and get as many to the peripheral streets as quick as possible because mm-hmm. when they bail, we already got half our perimeter set up.
Gotcha. We've learned a lot this hour, and I want to thank all three of our guests for not only telling the story of what happened last Wednesday, but also being willing to do what they do. Sheriff Baxter, thank you. He's here not only representing the Monroe County Sheriff's Department, but today, four different departments
yes,
worked
sir.
On that story.
It's an honor to do that.
Thank you. We appreciate that. And Max Schulte and Georgie Silverol from the Democrat and Chronicle. Harrowing stuff. I do hope you, honestly, you take a little bit of time for yourself.
Yeah, I'm gonna unplug for a little bit.
I'll buy you a glass of wine sometime.
Sounds good. Maybe two.
Bring over a six.
Sounds like Will Cleveland's job is in order.
Yeah, no, I'm gonna tell Will we'll grab a few beers and catch up away from work. Thank you for what you do, Max.
All right, thanks, man.
And Georgie, thanks. Really appreciate the work that you're doing now with the Democrat and Chronicle. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Rob Braden is the engineer, and Megan Mack is the producer of Connections. I hope you are a member, because when we say member-supported public radio, it's because of you. Thanks for that. We'll talk to you tomorrow.